This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We're going to start the program today with a big picture look at the world economy, specifically how China and other Asian nations are growing at such a clip that they're actually due to overtake the United States. Based on current trends, China alone will be the dominant economic power within just a few years. By some measures, it already is bigger than the United States. And this is a really fascinating subject in light of biblical prophecies of the end time, many of which paint a picture of how the world is going to look economically. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this really fascinating subject. If you're familiar with the Trumpet Magazine at all and thetrumpet.com, you know that we offer quite a lot of free literature, books, booklets, and magazines. One of the ways that we take requests is through our in-house call center. We have staff members and volunteers taking calls all the time from people interested in learning more about the subjects that we cover. I wanted to give you an inside look at this important dimension of what we do. I find it pretty inspiring myself. I've asked our call center manager, Harley Breath, to come in and talk to us today. Is your heart older than you are? A new study estimates that 3 out of 4 American adults have a predicted heart age older than their chronological age, putting them at greater risk for heart problems like heart attack and stroke. We're going to talk with nutritionist and fitness coach Jorg Mardian about this study, and we're going to see what you can do to actually reverse this trend in your own heart. And I'll conclude today's program with a few words about being a person of your word. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The world economy is changing. It's been centered around the United States for a long time, but that center of gravity is shifting east. Asia boasts fast-growing economies that promise to actually overtake the United States economically. A new report from a UK-based economic center says the number one economy in the next few years will be China. We're going to talk about why this is something we need to be concerned about right now based on the prophecies of the Bible. Here in the studio, we have trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So give us the facts here. How is China about to become the world's largest economy?
Right. Well, they call this the China miracle, and it is really one of the big, I guess, success stories of a growing economy in modern history. As you're looking back just as short as like 1950, China was kind of like a third world backwater that the rest of the world didn't pay much heed to. And here now they are with a $12 trillion economy, second biggest economy in the world in terms of just overall money possessed. But then even if you use a term economists call like purchasing power parity, or what can you buy with that money, that because things cost cheaper in China, you can actually buy about $23 trillion worth of goods in China with that $12 trillion worth of money. So I guess that gets kind of complicated. But by some measures, economists are saying China is already the world's biggest economy.
So how does that affect economic dealings in the world today? The United States, having been top dog for decades now, with China challenging it for that pole position, how does that affect the way that the world economy operates?
Right. Well, when you look at all the other nations around the world, I mean, international trade's a big thing, and a lot of countries are actually, which have traditionally kind of been in the U.S. economic political orbit, are kind of jumping ship. We talked quite a bit on this program last week about Panama, which had used to been real close U.S. ally, and even allies with Taiwan, which is a U.S. another U.S. ally. And now they've kind of thrown Taiwan under the bus, and they've established an embassy in Beijing, and they've let Chinese companies control the ports on both sides of the Panama Canal, just because they've got their nose to the fire or something like that. That you can, they can see which way the wind's blowing, and that this is a rising power in the world. Like I said, this UK-based report, they argue a little bit back and forth over how much China economy is going to grow. But they say if it grows at 6.3% by 2032, China will be bigger than the U.S. economy, even in absolute terms, like GDP terms.
Mm-hmm. So we had talked about some of the trade relationships that China has been establishing, the growth that China is experiencing really as a result of these, the way that it's engaging with the rest of the world. Donald Trump seems to be fairly confident in the way that he has spoken, certainly as he was campaigning for the presidency. It's been a little bit quieter since he's been president, basically talking about how the United States is able to dictate terms in these trade relationships. But in your view, how much leverage does the United States have? And how hard is China and maybe other countries working to undermine the leverage that America does have?
Right. Well, President Donald Trump, he has had a good stock market rally under his presidency, and that may have given the United States a little bit more leverage in these trade deals. But it seems to be, when you look at the long-term trends, kind of like a drop in the bucket, that a lot of these countries are realizing that China's a growing power, and China's formed this this trade alliance. They call it the BRICS. It stands as an acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And all of those together are already not quite, but almost as big as the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. And so working as a group, they get especially a lot of like developing third world nations that maybe have some concern over the U.S. dictating human rights to them, that want an alternative that will just give them investment money with no questions asked about how many people they've killed in a certain village, are starting to look to this BRICS alliance as like an alternative. And like I said, this UK report showing that in their estimate, by 2032, three of the world's top five economies will be in Asia. China will be number one. United States will still be number two, according to this report.
Based on current trends, just the growth projection based on what's happening right now.
Right. But on this one, it's the U.S. and Germany are the only Western nations on that list.
India
is on the
star.
Would be on the top five within the next decade or so, and Japan will lose its current place as third, but it will still be in the top five. And so I've seen other reports that really, like the long-term thinkers, saying that by 2050, we really have to rely on America's alliance with Europe if you're going to counterbalance Asia. They said U.S. has an $18 trillion economy. Europe has an $18 trillion economy. Together, you have a $36 trillion economy, which will grow some, but basically it says that if the U.S. and Europe stick together, by 2050, this power block will be roughly equal to the Asian power block of Russia, China, India, Brazil, this BRICS power block, which is kind of what we're here pointing out in this program, is that's kind of all the calculus is that we need U.S. and Europe on the same team if we're going to get an economic block big enough to even equal what Asia is going to be by the middle part of this century. And yet the Bible has good indications that Europe, not more than good indications, I mean explicit statements, that Europe's not going to stay on the same team as the U.S. As a matter of fact, it's going to jump ship and go over to this Asian bloc. And then with the European Union's economy, plus this huge Asian behemoth that's taking up the lion's share of world GDP, the U.S. is going to be looking quite small if those within a fairly short number of years if those countries stick together.
It's quite extraordinary to watch this trend, say, to look at this report and to see the way that they're describing the direction that these different economies are going and making these projections in light of the prophecies that we understand for the end time, the way that this is going to unfold. And it's quite extraordinary to look at how many of those prophecies really do relate to economic trends. Just thinking about the kings of the East— prophecy that's talking about China and Russia and Japan and India and these Asian nations, the way that they're going to band together politically. Certainly there will be an economic factor associated with that. But especially just as you were talking, I'm thinking about the prophecies of the economics of this European power that is rising. It really describes this in very explicit terms, the fact that this is going to be an economic powerhouse on its own right. I mean, this is even preceding, I guess, or this is maybe the ultimate outcome of the relationship that you're describing between the trade relationship between Europe and Asia that will actually undermine America's economic dominance. I'd like to talk about that a little bit. Maybe you could start by just telling us a little bit about what the Bible says about this unification or this this common market that we're expecting to see actually between Europe and Asia.
Right, and this is something that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, he has pretty much a whole chapter on in his Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet, going through the prophecies in the book of Isaiah from the Bible about economics. What are economics going to look like in the end time? And Isaiah 23 in particular is kind of the pivotal chapter in that book. And it describes this huge, actually two big trade alliances that work together. And it's a little confusing if you don't know the modern identity of nations, but it's basically the two big players in these trade alliances is a power called Kittim and a power called Tyre. And then there's many other nations that flow into these orbits. But then it talks about that Kittim and Tyre working together to form this huge economic alliance that just really dominates the world trade scene. Mm-hmm. And they go through there's the whole sidebar in that booklet about Kittim, which was they were a descendant of Japheth in the Old Testament. And then they settled up in Cyprus, which is where they were in Bible times. And then it tracks their migrations, though, from Cyprus up through Turkey, up through what we'd call southern Russia now, into the eastern parts of the world, like where China is now. And then Tyre is similar. That was a huge trade empire with a very strong religious component to it that moved into Europe. So really, and the book brings out all the details of these migrations, but showing that Kittim and Tyre is really what you'd call the Holy Roman Empire or Germany, a united Europe, and then China, this united Asia. Mm-hmm. And then they've got all these other powers like Greece and Russia and that kind of work their way into one of these two trade blocks. And for a time, they work together. Like I said, right now, Europe's more in America's orbit, mm-hmm. and China's kind of something that even secular an analyst can see as a rival economic power. But this prophecy in Isaiah, when you understand who these nations are, it shows that there will be like a double cross where the Tyre, this Holy Roman Empire, Europe, will go over to the Asian side, at least temporarily. It doesn't, it's not a strong alliance. It doesn't last too long.
Yeah, the implication is actually that it is explicitly intended to undermine America's economic dominance.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of something that right now you see that America's the economic superpower. And so it definitely makes sense that rival powers who'd want to be the superpower would, in the initial stages, you've got to kind of team up on the big power. And then once that power is taken down, the alliance isn't actually deep enough that they're just going to like share and be kind and help the whole new world unified order.
Yeah.
It's going to be going to start turning on each other.
Mm-hmm. So then, you know, just again, going back to some of those prophecies about what happens economically within Europe, it talks about it being just an absolute powerhouse and doing business with merchants of the earth all over the world, having a certain amount of almost a monopolistic type of dominance for a time. And you see the way that this engine is building in Asia that really will serve to come after that and be, you know, to undermine Europe's dominance. It's going to be a very short-lived kind of experience there within Europe.
Right, and it's because these are not just Old Testament prophecies as well, because even you go into the New Testament, like Revelation 18, I mean, that chapter is describing the downfall of this economic system, but it talks about how, like, the merchants of the earth just wail and they howl because this huge trade behemoth that made them just so filthy rich while it existed has fallen apart. And that uses the words more like Babylon, which is just, it's the same thing as the Tyre. So it's talking more about the European component of this, which it does show that right now it kind of looks like China's the big threat, but it actually shows that, I mean, China will provide a lot of ships and markets and resources to this trade bloc. But when you combine the other scriptures in the New Testament, like Revelation 18 and Revelation 13, it puts more emphasis on the Babylon or the seven-hilled city, or like what Rome is today.
So economists are watching this economic infrastructure being built today that is really kind of a setting the world up for a massive rivalry. If they're looking at it from the standpoint of Europe and the United States maybe being combined as a counterweight to this mammoth economic power that's growing within Asia. And in one sense, they're right that when you look at the ultimate outcome here, it really is a cataclysmic rivalry that basically explodes right at the very end of the age between this economic power, military, political power within Europe and the rival power within Asia. The United States has already been eliminated from the picture, but it is quite amazing to look at these headlines, compare it with what we know is going to be happening in the time ahead, and recognizing that we're seeing the groundwork being laid for the fulfillment of these prophecies right before our eyes. You mentioned the Isaiah booklet. That has a lot of information about Isaiah 23 and the Mart of Nations, this short-lived a cooperation that we're expecting to see between Europe and Asia. Any other resources that you might point someone to if they were interested in more information about these prophecies?
Right. Well, the Isaiah booklet definitely. Also, our Ezekiel End Time Prophet booklet has, it talks about parallel scriptures to that probably focuses a little more on the effect this trade alliance is going to have on America, about just like the rioting and pestilence and things like that happens as a result of being subjected to a huge global trade embargo.
Yeah, it seems like one other excellent resource is the Russia and China in Prophecy booklet that just gives the real overview of these what end up being hot war developing between this European superpower and this Asian conglomerate. It's all spelled out quite explicitly in the book of Revelation. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about China's growing economic heft, as well as India and Japan, other Asian nations that are really shifting the balance of power economically in the world away from the United States. Andrew, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Trumpet is not your typical news magazine. It is offered for free as an educational service in the public interest. The same is true of everything that our editorial department produces. We offer over 100 books and booklets, along with other magazines and a correspondence course. We have extensive operations in place in order to give this material away to the largest audience possible, including our team of people who operate our call center, taking calls from interested readers and viewers of our television program, The Key of David. And I wanted to give you a behind-the-scenes look at what goes into this aspect of our work. We have here in the studio our call center manager, Harley Breath. Hello, Harley.
Hi, good morning.
It's good to have you here. So I want to just talk about two parts of your job in particular, the people calling in and the people who are manning the phones. But let's start by just talking about the operators. A lot of organizations would use a professional call center service for this type of thing. But the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, he said that he wanted to use our own folks, our own people who are invested in this work. Why did he do that? Why do you suppose?
Well, I think you alluded to it a little bit in your introduction. You talked about how we give everything away for free. You talked about how that's one of the truths of this work, one of the doctrines of this work, really. We give it away freely, and I think our people are right there willing to give themselves their own time away for free, and they, as you said, they're members. In a sense, they're actually better in many ways than a professional group. We actually used professional individuals before. And I think that history is interesting, and it just kind of informs why we use our own people. But we certainly do use our own people, and I believe strongly that they are better than a professional crew because they love it. Anything that we give away for free, they've read it. They know it. Mm-hmm. You can't call it a product. It's not a product. We don't sell it, and it's to us more important than that. But if you were going to equate it with something like that, they would know that quote unquote product inside and out, and they do.
Yeah. So we do have a few full time staff, and we use students at Herbert W. Armstrong College, but a great many of our call center operators are volunteer. Can you just tell us about the actual crew that's manning the phones?
Sure. We have over 100 of them. It varies, but we have a crew of over 100, about 105 to 110 operators at any given time. They're all over North America. So we have operators in Canada, some of them, and all over the United States.
So that's pretty unusual in and of itself, that we do have a call center here on the campus where the offices of the Trumpet are located, but we've also got people scattered all over the place who are able to take calls for us.
Exactly, all the way from West Coast to the Far East Coast. We've had people in Newfoundland and Labrador and all the way down to the bottom West Coast of California, so spanning the entire North America, basically. And they're volunteer, like you said. So we have people that help when they're able, but they certainly are able very often, and that revolves around the Key of David for the most part, and then also our Trumpet magazine, and I think somewhat also the Royal Vision magazine as well. Mm-hmm. So our main magazines, but especially the Key of David, is where we have a lot of emphasis. At any given time on a Sunday, we would have more operators on the phone than we do.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit. The Key of David, that airs on mostly, Friday and Sunday for the most part.
Yes, sir.
And that's when the biggest volume of calls comes in. So just tell us about, say, what it would be typical for a day that we're airing the Key of David and what they call a call operators experience.
Well, I think they basically can just volunteer their time whenever's best for them. But we have people getting up really early. For example, sometimes it's very early. And this is all, we don't ask them necessarily to get on at any given time. They just get on whenever they can. And amazingly, it works. we don't have to be overly micromanaging the schedule or anything like that, because the people just love to be a part of it. Our members do. So let's say that some of them would just wake up on a Sunday. They would look for the times when the Key of David ends and when we're offering the literature, and then they would just hop on the phones and be ready to take those calls. And they come and what you might call like a tsunami of calls just comes all at once, and then we take the calls when the end of the finale of the program airs, mm-hmm. and our 1-800 number splashes across the screen. They're there, and you know, we provide training to them in certain ways so they have any materials they might need, and they just take the calls. They speak to people from all over. We get calls, even most of them are from the United States, clearly, because that's where our television stations are. But as you know, we also have a call center that's kind of separate over now in Edstone in England. And we do sometimes get callers from even that far if they call our United States number. Mm. So it is really interesting to talk to people. We hear real life things happening in their lives out there. They share with us over the phone, and that can be interesting to hear as well, just how it's really affecting them, how they're using it, how they're trying to apply what they learn. They've never heard it before sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, tell us your experience and just this really is kind of the front line of contact with our audience that we're trying to reach with all of the literature, the magazines and everything. And particularly when you have a Key of David program air, we're putting that literature offer up there. If you want more information, get this booklet or that booklet. People are making that call. There's a certain level of interest in there. Maybe you can just give us your perspective on having that contact with those who are interested in learning more about what we're teaching.
I think for me personally, just some of my greatest experiences are talking to people who are trying to implement what we're teaching, what Mr. Fleury's teaching, and what they hear on the Key of David. And, you know, I think you just find that a lot of people have a lot of questions about a lot of things with religion because they're hearing so many different conflicting things from preachers or from religion out there. And they often have never heard anything like what Mr. Fleury's talking about on the Key of David. It's just totally new. And, for example, we hear people that talk about how they're trying to implement this, and they have so many questions, they don't know where to start. Maybe it's dealing with something as simple as teaching their children. And that's something everybody faces. Everybody has a family. They have a mother, they have a father, they have most of the time brothers or sisters, and oftentimes children, and they're trying to teach them, they're trying to guide them. And our literature does that. Our literature is not all about prophecy. It's not all about news. That certainly plays into it, but mm-hmm. our literature is about family matters as well. It's about how to guide your life in this world that we have that's very much without morality in so many ways now. And I think, you know, when people ask us, sometimes I've had people over the phone ask me, or ask our operators, and they inform me of this, you know, what would you do in my situation? And they're just trying to get answers to their life. And I think in every case, we would want to be able to kind of, you know, reach out and give them some guidance. But honestly, we do something better than that. We point them to the literature where we've Mr. Fleury and other ministers that are writing these books and booklets that we have. They're pointing them, they're guiding them, they're directing them back to the Bible, really, yeah. And what the answer is there.
Give them an opportunity to study into it in depth and check everything out with the Bible and make sure that they're really proving it out.
Right, because how valuable can it be if someone out there that they're going to for some other church is giving them their opinion, and then they might think we're giving them our opinion, but it is actually kind of different. We're giving them what the Bible teaches.
Yeah.
So we want them to be able to prove it for themselves.
Yeah.
That's why we don't give them our opinions over the phone. We direct them back to the literature, which points them to the Bible. So
let's talk a little bit about some of the folks that you work with, the folks who are actually volunteering and putting their time in to help us out in this way. Maybe you could just give us some stories about the people who are contributing in this very special way.
Sure. Well, I think just a few months ago, I had an opportunity to be around some of the members of the church that were helping out in this way. And I think of one couple in particular and this is just a story about it, but as you asked, and I have many other stories about it, but I happened to be around this couple for a few days in a row, and they would come up to me each day and just let me know how much they appreciated taking calls. And in fact, each of these mornings they came up to me, it was actually several days in a row, every single morning they had taken calls of their own free will, and they love it. They would come up to me and just give me every detail and let me know how amazing it was. They would thank me, even though, you know, I'm not due for the credit of being able to take these calls, but they would thank me for being able to take these calls. They just love hearing the way that it impacts people. Mm-hmm. These were some people that I met up in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
So again, our volunteers are taking calls all over the United States, and I think actually our callers in a lot of ways correlate to the demographics of the people that are taking the calls for us as members of the church. We have people from all walks of life taking the calls. We have people from all walks of life that are on the other end too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hearing from, you know, wonderful feedback from our people, but also from the people that that are taking the calls.
So you mentioned that earlier on that we had actually used a professional call service. Maybe you could just give us a little bit of the history of the program, how it developed into the form that it is today, and maybe why some of those choices were made.
Sure. Well, in the beginning, we actually had not, now this would be back in about 1998, just before 2000, but we had not yet aired the nationwide telephone number on the Key of David at this point. And then once Mr. Fleury did that, Mr. Gerald Fleury did air the nationwide number on the Key of David program, we knew we were going to get quite a few calls. So at that point, the person who was running the program, I believe it was Mr. Shane Granger at that point, who was doing a lot of the training. Anyway, we expected about 1,000 calls, but we ended up getting over 1,800 calls just that first initial weekend when we aired the number on the nationwide program. So we had to do something about it. We had to find a way to expand. Now, we were using a company in Pittsburgh prior to this to take our calls for us. And that was working because it was a way for us to take the calls without investing a lot of money up front, mm-hmm. $10,000 or more. We didn't have to do that up front. We were able to employ another call center to do it for us for about $1,000 at the beginning, again, around 1998. So then once we realized that we needed our own call center, I think that was in it was about spring 2000, we purchased the hardware and software that we needed in order to have our own call center. And that was down in downtown Edmond. So that's before my time.
I staffed that call center. Yeah, I was answering calls in that call center.
I feel a little funny talking about this when.
Well, it's changed a lot since I was manning those phones. Yeah, we were filling out little slips of paper with ballpoint pens. Yeah,
that's what we still do. No, I'm just joking. But so some upgrades on the technology side now, but. But what's amazing is back then, our members were just as eager to be a part of it because we had about 1/3 of the entire Edmond congregation want to be a part of that. So 45 people volunteered to train for the call center at that point. I guess you would have been one of those 45, I imagine. So,
yep.
But anyway, I think that from that history, we go on and we see. I even brought a quote with me that I love because we have this in our cubicles. It's there. It's kind of it supplements kind of like a mission statement for us in the call center. And it's from Mr. Gerald Fleury. And he just said, having our own people answer the phones will make a huge difference in our message reaching the masses. I believe it will probably double or triple the Key of David's effectiveness. And then he said, the reason is because our people will work extremely hard to serve the callers and they will never be curt or rude. So we have that there beside us in every single cubicle. And I think we can see from that that's why Mr. Fleury wanted to have our own people do it.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked in call centers where I wasn't even a part of the company before. I was someone was contracting us to take their calls for them. And I've done that. So taking calls for another company, it works, but this is not your product. You do not believe in it the same way they do.
Right. Well, that's outstanding. If somebody wanted to call in, if they were interested, can we give a number that they can call here on the radio?
Absolutely. So if anyone wanted to call, they could call us at 1-800-772-8577. And that's whether they have an interest in the literature, they want to request it, our magazine.
Yeah.
Or anything else. I mean, anything all the way.
That's the Key of David number, isn't it?
That's our literature request line.
Literature request line.
So
okay.
It's more of a generic number that we use for everything.
1-800?
1-800-772-8577.
Excellent. All right. Well, we've been talking with our call center manager, Harley Breath, about this important aspect of the work that we do here at thetrumpet.com and The Trumpet. We appreciate your time, Harley.
Thank you very much.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Is your heart older than you are? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have issued a report estimating that 3 out of 4 American adults have a predicted heart age older than their chronological age, putting them at greater risk for heart disease. And this is a really interesting way of looking at your heart health. I have nutritionist and personal trainer Jorg Mardian here via Skype from his office in British Columbia. Hello, Jorg.
How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
Well, the same.
So tell us about this study. What have they found here?
I'd like to begin by framing it. So if you're the type of person that's going to get up out of bed eager to knock down the dominoes each morning, if you've got lots of energy, then probably this study doesn't apply to you. But for the others, the research states that your heart may be functionally older than your real chronological age. So this was a really interesting study. It's a little sobering when you look at the statistics, but I had some fun with the study itself. Various news outlets quoted the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which released this study on September 2nd, and they estimated, and get this, that 3 out of 4 adults in the United States have a predicted functional heart age older than their chronological age. So just to get a little context, that's about 69 million U.S. adults between the ages of 30 and 74. And to further that context, that's about the number of people living in the 130 largest U.S. cities combined. And they're at risk. So that's no small number. Now, what type of risk are we talking about? There's nearly 800,000 Americans that die of heart-related conditions each year. And their illnesses cost about $320 billion annually, according to the American Heart Association. So this is no small factor. So what is heart age? Heart age is the age of your heart and blood vessels as a result of your risk factors. So if you smoke, or if you have high blood pressure, if your heart age is going to be much higher than your actual age.
In other words, you're 35 years old, but because you smoke or you've got early onset diabetes, something like that, it's like you're walking around with a 45-year-old's heart.
Yes. Yes. So the risk factors are pretty clear. High blood pressure would be a big risk factor. High cholesterol. If you have diabetes, of course. Smoking is a huge one. And my two that I always get back to with clients is unhealthy diet and physical inactivity. And as well, which is one of the biggest problems facing North America today, obesity. having an unmanageable body weight. And the more of a risk profile you have, it's said that the older your heart age is. And that doesn't mean that people have to be discouraged by that. It simply means that they need to change their habits.
Right. This report that I read about this, it said specifically that you can actually lower your heart age. You can take steps that reverse that trend if your heart is aging faster than it should. So that's definitely something that's encouraging. It seems to me like that's actually kind of what they were going for here, is trying to frame this discussion of heart health in a way that would give people a certain amount of a wake-up call to do something different.
Well, it's, you know, this is really interesting because the way that they used to give the risk factors for people is to say, well, you have 10 or 20% chance of heart disease in so many years, or you have so many years before, a heart attack or heart disease. And this concept, when we look at it, we say, well, it was developed. And why was it developed? Well, interestingly, it was developed by experts who worked on called a Framingham Heart Study. And that's an ongoing cardiovascular study, which began in 1948 and is now in a third generation of participants. And what they're trying to do right now is just give people a less ambiguous way to look at their heart age and to change. So if you say, look, you've got a 10% chance of heart disease, you might say, well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I'll take that. 90% chance of not having heart disease.
Exactly. Well, who isn't going to say that? But doctors will say, no, that's unacceptable. We don't accept that. But if we tell you, and this is where this concept comes in very nice. If we say, look, your heart age is 10 years older than your chronological age. So if you're 55 and you have a heart age of 65, they found that they can actually get people to respond to that. And that's they actually had a clinical trial in Europe where they told people their heart age, and these people improved their heart health much more than people who were told their absolute risk of cardiovascular disease. Because in that trial, when they learned their heart age, they were able to reduce it by 1.5 years over the course of 1 year, compared with a reduction of only 0.3 years for those who were given the traditional risk information. So that was very interesting. So when you understand the concept, it helps you to frame the risk better, and then it leads to an action and with a better viable outcome. So if you understand what the risk is, you're more liable to make a change.
So this study actually showed that, what was the average? They say 3 out of 4 adults had a predicted heart age older than their chronological age. What was the average in terms of the gap between those two?
2 in 5 women have a heart age that's 5 or more years older than their chronological age. And the average cardiovascular age for adult men was 8 years older.
Wow.
Than their actual age.
That's pretty terrible.
Well, it is because think of it this way. When you think about how much your heart beats and works every year, that's a lot of work and a lot of stress. And if you multiply that by 7 years, that's a lot of output. So if you're an athlete, your heart age is going to be much less than, say, a sedentary person, because you have a strong heart that beats very strongly and your blood pressure is nice and even. And somebody who's sedentary, they're going to have all kinds of problems. So you're just looking at a heart on the reverse ends of the spectrum.
So you're saying if you're over age 30 and you're a male, your heart, if you're average, your heart is 8 years older than you are.
That's what the studies say, yes. And that's what was so interesting. And for women, it's a little less. For men, it's more. I'm not sure what they determine that on, but that's what the statistics say. Interestingly, they say an older heart was seen across all racial and ethnic groups in the U.S., but it was highest among African Americans. And they say those who are more affluent, they have a lower heart age. So I'm not sure if that has to do with poverty and being able to eat better. Mm-hmm. I would suspect that had a big, a lot to do with that, being able to have more healthy foods rather than eating out refined foods. When we look at people coming through our clinic here, I mean, the problems that we encounter always comes down to two, well, not always, in large part comes down to two big factors, not exercising enough and not eating good food. Refined food is, you're dealing with chemicals, additives, steroids, you're dealing with unhealthy fats, sugars, and all of those have a big impact on the body. And many people just never factor that in. They just don't read their labels. If you don't read labels, that has a lot to do with impacting your heart as well. And then, of course, if you're sitting on the couch coming home, you're tired from work, you're sitting there 8 hours looking at a computer screen, and then you come home and you sit another 6 hours in front of the TV, well, your body's not doing much. Mm-hmm. You're not pumping a lot of blood. I mean, you're surviving, but you're not thriving.
So this is basically, when you talk about what you do to lower your heart age, you mentioned people who over the course of a year were actually able to dial backward a year and a half, basically like 2.5 years of youthfulness. These are the factors that you would look at first. Stop smoking, look at your diet, and start getting active.
Well, the physical inactivity, they call for 150 minutes every week of moderate intensity exercise, such as, say, brisk walking. I would call for more than that. I mean, that would be the minimum for me. But again, walking leads to movement, and eat a healthier diet, low in unhealthy fats and salts, more vegetables, of course. Maintain a healthy body weight. That's huge. Smoking is never on anyone's list. I mean, that's just a death sentence. Diabetes, you have to control. So you have to have help with that. Cholesterol has a lot to do with your dietary intake, of course. And high blood pressure, hand in hand. Get control of those goals. Make sure that the big seven factors that I just mentioned, those are the prescription for a younger heart.
So if somebody is interested in actually getting a little more information about the age of their heart, this organization that you talked about, the Farmingham study, they have an online calculator that you can go to. And so how do they calculate that? How do you find out based on that what your heart health would be?
Right. So that study is on FarminghamHeartStudy.org, and they have a nifty little calculator there. It's called a heart age predictor using your BMI, body mass index, and you would punch in male or female, how old you are. You would have to know your systolic blood pressure, and you could get that from your doctor. They would ask you several questions, including, are you being treated for hypertension? Are you a smoker? Are you diabetic? And then the last one would be, what is your body mass index? And the body mass index, again, can be measured by your doctor. Or they actually have some nice devices on the market right now, scales that you can step on to get that. Now, calculating that, it gives you your vascular age with a 10-year risk. You know, and this is a great, great little tool for people who are inactive. However, again, we want to frame that because if you're active, body mass index is a considered a healthiness of weight. But if you're short or tall, if you're muscular, if you're an athlete, that body mass index is not going to work. It does not account for non-average muscle density, muscle size or frame size.
Well, that's a pretty big deviation factor there.
Well, it's true, because if you have somebody that works out with weights four times a week, that person is going to have a lot of lean muscle on them. And so their body fat might be low. You might sit at, say, 13 or 14% body fat. But the body mass index does not understand how to measure that, because it's just a set of questions. So your body mass index will probably show that you're obese. It does with me. It's the opposite end of the spectrum. It does me no use. But if I take my body fat, it shows it correctly.
Yeah, just so our radio listeners are aware, Jörg Mardian is not obese by any measure, except BMI, apparently. So, well, that's very interesting. We've been talking with nutritionist Jörg Mardian about this study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And he, thankfully, has graciously agreed to write up an article about this for thetrumpet.com. We'll put a link in that article to this online calculator if you're interested in finding out your own cardiovascular age. So we look forward to reading that. You can find that article on thetrumpet.com. Thanks again, Jörg, for your time.
It's my pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
I'll do it, you say. Then the time comes to do it. What happens? Do you keep your word? When you tell your friend you'll meet him at 6 o'clock, are you ready and waiting at 6 o'clock? When you say you'll have that project ready by Wednesday morning, is it finished on Tuesday night? When you say you'll do something, do people know it's as good as done? Are you a man or woman of your word? How often do people break their word to you? They say they'll be there at 7:30 sharp or help you move your furniture, and then they say, oh, I forgot, or something came up. Sorry, dude. Often there's no explanation, there's no apology. How often have you done this? Society today simply doesn't prioritize keeping one's word, and we tend to rationalize it. Things happen, no big deal. So most of us fail to recognize just what a serious character issue breaking our word is. Orison Swett Marden wrote this in his 1916 book, Making Life a Masterpiece. Only recently, a prominent public man was criticized throughout the newspaper world as one not having enough character to keep his promises. He had not the stamina to make good when to do so proved difficult. Now, that's so often the issue. You say you'll do something and then circumstances change and you realize there's inconvenience involved that you didn't anticipate. And suddenly, what you said you would do doesn't seem worth it. But think about the long-term cost of losing your credibility. Think about the high cost of developing a reputation for being unreliable. Think about the high cost of compromising your character. Marden continued, he had not the timber, the character fiber to stand up and do the thing he knew to be right and that he had promised to do. The world is full of these jellyfish people who have not lime enough in their backbone to stand erect to do the right thing. They're always stepping into the spotlight in the good intention stage. And then when the reckoning time comes, taking the line of least resistance, doing the thing which will cost the least effort or money, regardless of later consequences. They think they can be as unscrupulous about breaking promises as they were about making them. But sooner or later, fate makes us play fair or get out of the game. What does God think about this subject? Well, he keeps his word. When he says he will do something, he does it. When he gives a promise, he keeps it. We can count on him to fulfill his every word, every time. Matthew 5:18 says, not one jot or tittle of his word will pass away before all of it is fulfilled. In the Old Testament, there are laws saying that if you vow a vow, you'd better keep it. And they tell us that it's better not to say something than to say it and not do it. Don't give your word if you're not going to keep it. When you think about it, breaking your word is actually breaking the ninth commandment, which forbids bearing false witness. When you give your word and then fail to follow through, that makes you a liar. We can say all kinds of potential lies without really thinking about it. I'll do it. I'll be there. I'll pick you up. I'll bring it over. I'll help you out. Don't say those things if you don't mean it and you're not willing to do it, even if circumstances make it inconvenient to do so. When you say, I'll do it, you're signing your name to the contract and committing your reputation and your character. Just a few decades ago, many, if not most, significant business transactions were sealed with a man's word and his handshake. No forms, no lawyers, no contracts. The man saying it was the contract. Modern society has gotten further and further from lives of honesty, uprightness, integrity, truth, trustworthiness. Now, agreements have to be bound by carefully worded, signed, notarized contracts because people can't be trusted to keep their word. If everyone struggled and fought to keep his word, no matter the obstacles, we wouldn't need contracts and lawyers. This issue of reliability, of keeping your word, it touches everything. Christ says, "Every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment." In his 1856 inaugural address at the University of Glasgow, Scotland, Lord Bulwer Lytton said, "A man is already of consequence in the world when it is known that we can implicitly rely upon him. I have frequently seen in life a person preferred to a long list of applicants for some important charge, which lifts him at once into station and fortune merely because he has this reputation, that when he says he knows a thing, he knows it, and when he says he will do a thing, he will do it." What is your reputation? Keeping your word should be as important as keeping the Ten Commandments, because it is keeping the Ten Commandments. It is actually the love of God. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests, Andrew Miller, Harley Breath, and Jörg Mardian. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Jesse Hester. I'll leave you with this thought from James Howell. An acre of performance is worth a whole world of promise. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.